Chapter 6. Car wheels made. Why, I was as fagged out then as if I had been chopping wood all day. My skull was splitting with headache. It seemed to me that I must go mad if I sat there any longer, so I undressed and went to bed. I stretched myself out in my berth, and, well, you know what the result was. The thing went right along, just the same. Clack, 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 a blue trip slip. Clack, 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 for an 8-cent fare. Clack, 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 a buff trip slip. Clack, 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 for a 6-cent fare, and so on, and so on, and so on. Punch in the presence of the passenger. Apostrophe, apostrophe, sleep. Not a single wink. I was almost a lunatic when I got to Boston. Don't ask me about the funeral. I did the best I could, but every solemn individual sentence was meshed and tangled and woven in and out with punch. Brothers, punch with care, punch in the presence of the passenger. Apostrophe, apostrophe, and the most distressing thing was that my delivery dropped into the undulating rhythm of those pulsing rhymes, and I could actually catch absent-minded people nodding time to the swing of it with their stupid heads. And, Mark, you may believe it or not, but before I got through, the entire assemblage were placidly bobbing their heads in solemn unison, mourners, undertaker, and all. The moment I had finished, I fled to the anteroom in a state bordering on frenzy. Of course it would be my luck to find a sorrowing and aged maiden aunt of the deceased there, who had arrived from Springfield too late to get into the church. She began to sob, and said, "Oh, oh, he is gone, and I didn't see him before he died." Apostrophe, apostrophe, yes. Apostrophe, apostrophe, I said, "He is gone, he is gone, he is gone, oh, will his suffering never cease?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, you loved him then. Oh, you too loved him. Apostrophe, loved him. Loved who? Apostrophe, why, my poor George, my poor nephew. Apostrophe, oh him. Yes, oh, yes, yes. Certainly, certainly. Punch, punch, oh, this misery will kill me. Apostrophe, apostrophe, bless you. Bless you, sir, for these sweet words. I too suffer in this dear loss. Were you present during his last moments? Apostrophe, yes. I whose last moments? Apostrophe, his. The dear departed's. Apostrophe, yes. Oh, yes, yes, yes. I suppose so, I think so, I don't know. Oh, certainly I was there. Apostrophe, apostrophe, oh, what a privilege. What a precious privilege. And his last words, dash, dash, oh, tell me his last words. What did he say? Apostrophe, he said, oh, my head, my head, my head. He said, he never said anything but punch, punch. Punch in the presence of the passenger. Oh, leave me, madam. In the name of all that is generous, leave me to my madness, my misery, my despair. A buff trip slip for a 6-cent fare, a pink trip slip for a 3-cent fare, and durance can no further go. Punch in the presence of the passenger. My friend's hopeless eyes rested upon mine a pregnant minute, and then he said impressively, "Mark, you do not say anything. You do not offer me any hope. But, ah me, it is just as well, it is just as well. You could not do me any good. The time has long gone by when words could comfort me. Something tells me that my tongue is doomed to wag forever to the jigger of that remorseless jingle. There, there, it is coming on me again. A blue trip slip for an 8-cent fare, a buff trip slip for a," thus murmuring faint and fainter, my friend sank into a peaceful trance, and forgot his sufferings in a blessed respite. How did I finally save him from an asylum? I took him to a neighboring university, and made him discharge the burden of his persecuting rhymes into the eager ears of the poor, unthinking students. How is it with them now? The result is too sad to tell. Why did I write this article? It was for a worthy, even a noble, purpose. It was to warn you, reader, if you should came across those merciless rhymes, to avoid them as you would a pestilence. The Great Revolution and Pitcairn, let me refresh the reader's memory a little. Nearly 100 years ago, the crew of the British ship Bounty mutinied, set the captain and his officers adrift upon the open sea, took possession of the ship, and sailed southward. They procured wives for themselves among the natives of Tahiti, then proceeded to a lonely little rock in mid-Pacific, called Pitcairn's Island, wrecked the vessel, stripped her of everything that might be useful to a new colony, and established themselves on shore. Pitcairn's is so far removed from the track of commerce that it was many years before another vessel touched there. It had always been considered an uninhabited island. So when a ship did at last drop its anchor there, in 1808, the captain was greatly surprised to find the place peopled. Although the mutineers had fought among themselves, and gradually killed each other off until only two or three of the original stock remained, these tragedies had not occurred before a number of children had been born. So in 1808 the island had a population of 27 persons. John Adams, the chief mutineer, still survived, and was to live many years yet, as governor and patriarch of the flock. From being mutineer and homicide, he had turned Christian and teacher, and his nation of 27 persons was now the purest and devoutest in Christendom. Adams had long ago hoisted the British flag, and constituted his island an appanage of the British crown. Today the population numbers 90 persons, 16 men, 19 women, 25 boys, and 30 girls, all descendants of the mutineers, all bearing the family names of those mutineers, and all speaking English, and English only. The island stands high up out of the sea, and has precipitous walls. It is about 3/4 of a mile long, and in places is as much as 1/2 mile wide. Such arable land as it affords is held by the several families, according to a division, made many years ago. There is some livestock, goats, pigs, chickens, and cats, but no dogs, and no large animals. There is one church building used also as a capital, a schoolhouse, and a public library. The title of the governor has been, for a generation or two, magistrate, and chief ruler, in subordination to Her Majesty the Queen of Great Britain. It was his province to make the laws, as well as execute them. His office was elective. Everybody over 17 years old had a vote, no matter about the sex. The sole occupations of the people were farming and fishing, their sole recreation, religious services. There has never been a shop in the island, nor any money. The habits and dress of the people have always been primitive, and their laws simple to puerility. They have lived in a deep Sabbath tranquility, far from the world and its ambitions and vexations, and neither knowing nor caring what was going on in the mighty empires that lie beyond their limitless ocean solitudes. Once in 3 or 4 years a ship touched there, moved them with age news of bloody battles, devastating epidemics, fallen thrones, and ruined dynasties, then traded them some soap and flannel for some yams and breadfruit, and sailed away, leaving them to retire into their peaceful dreams and pious dissipations once more. On the 8th of last September, Admiral de Horsey, Commander-in-Chief of the British fleet in the Pacific, visited Pitcairn's Island, and speaks as follows in his official report to the Admiralty. They have beans, carrots, turnips, cabbages, and a little maize, pineapples, fig trees, custard apples, and oranges, lemons, and coconuts. Clothing is obtained alone from passing ships, in barter for refreshments. There are no springs on the island, but as it rains generally once a month they have plenty of water, although at times in former years they have suffered from drought. No alcoholic liquors, except for medicinal purposes, are used, and a drunkard is unknown. The necessary articles required by the islanders are best shown by those we furnished in barter for refreshments. Namely, flannel, serge, drill, half boots, combs, tobacco, and soap. They also stand much in need of maps and slates for their school, and tools of any kind are most acceptable. I caused them to be supplied from the public stores with a Union Jack for display on the arrival of ships, and a pit saw, of which they were greatly in need. This, I trust, will meet the approval of their lordships. If the munificent people of England were only aware of the wants of this most deserving little colony, they would not long go unsupplied. Divine services held every Sunday at 10:30 a.m. and at 3 p.m. in the house built and used by John Adams for that purpose until he died in 1829. It is conducted strictly in accordance with the liturgy of the Church of England by Mr. Simon Young, their selected pastor, who is much respected. A Bible class is held every Wednesday, when all who conveniently can attend. There is also a general meeting for prayer on the first Friday in every month. Family prayers are said in every house the first thing in the morning, and the last thing in the evening, and no food is partaken of without asking God's blessing before and afterward. Of these islanders' religious attributes no one can speak without deep respect. A people whose greatest pleasure and privilege is to commune in prayer with their God, and to join in hymns of praise, and who are, moreover, cheerful, diligent, and probably freer from vice than any other community, need no priest among them. Now I come to a sentence in the Admiral's report which he dropped carelessly from his pen, no doubt, and never gave the matter a second thought. He little imagined what a freight of tragic prophecy it bore. This is the sentence. One stranger, an American, has settled on the island a doubtful acquisition. A doubtful acquisition, indeed. Captain Ormsby, in the American ship Hornet, touched at Pitcairn's nearly 4 months after the Admiral's visit, and from the facts which he gathered there we now know all about that American. Let us put these facts together in historical form. The American's name was Butterworth Stavely. As soon as he had become well acquainted with all the people, and this took but a few days, of course he began to ingratiate himself with them by all the arts he could command. He became exceedingly popular, and much looked up to, for one of the first things he did was to forsake his worldly way of life, and throw all his energies into religion. He was always reading his Bible, or praying, or singing hymns, or asking blessings. In prayer, no one had such liberty as he, no one could pray so long or so well. At last, when he considered the time to be ripe, he began secretly to sow the seeds of discontent among the people. It was his deliberate purpose, from the beginning, to subvert the government, but of course he kept that to himself for a time. He used different arts with different individuals. He awakened dissatisfaction in one quarter by calling attention to the shortness of the Sunday services. He argued that there should be 3 3-hour services on Sunday instead of only 2. Many had secretly held this opinion before. They now privately banded themselves into a party to work for it. He showed certain of the women that they were not allowed sufficient voice in the prayer meetings. Thus another party was formed. No weapon was beneath his notice. He even descended to the children, and awoke discontent in their breasts, because, as he discovered for them, they had not enough Sunday school. This created a third party. Now, as the chief of these parties, he found himself the strongest power in the community. So he proceeded to his next move, a no less important one than the impeachment of the chief magistrate, James Russell Nicoy. A man of character and ability, and possessed of great wealth, he being the owner of a house with a parlor to it, 3 acres and a half of yam land, and the only boat in Pitcairn's, a whaleboat, and, most unfortunately, a pretext for this impeachment offered itself at just the right time. One of the earliest and most precious laws of the Isle, and was the law against trespass. It was held in great reverence, and was regarded as the palladium of the people's liberties. About 30 years ago an important case came before the courts under this law, in this wise. A chicken belonging to Elizabeth Young, aged, at that time, 58, a daughter of John Mills, one of the mutineers of the Bounty, trespassed upon the grounds of Thursday, October Christian, aged 29, a grandson of Fletcher Christian, one of the mutineers. Christian killed the chicken. According to the law, Christian could keep the chicken, or, if he preferred, he could restore its remains to the owner and receive damages in rajus to an amount equivalent to the waste and injury wrought by the trespasser. The court records set forth that he said Christian aforesaid did deliver the aforesaid remains to the said Elizabeth Young, and did demand one bushel of yams in satisfaction of the damage done. But Elizabeth Young considered the demand exorbitant. The parties could not agree. Therefore, Christian brought suit in the courts. He lost his case in the justices' court. At least, he was awarded only a half peck of yams, which he considered insufficient, and in the nature of a defeat. He appealed. The case lingered several years in an ascending grade of courts, and always resulted in decrees sustaining the original verdict. And finally the thing got into the Supreme Court, and there it stuck for 20 years. But last summer, even the Supreme Court managed to arrive at a decision at last. Once more the original verdict was sustained. Christian then said he was satisfied. But Stavely was present, and whispered to him, and to his lawyer, suggesting, as a mere form, that the original law be exhibited, in order to make sure that it still existed. It seemed an odd idea, but an ingenious one. So the demand was made. A messenger was sent to the magistrate's house. He presently returned with the tidings that it had disappeared from among the state archives. The court now pronounced its late decision void, since it had been made under a law which had no actual existence. Great excitement ensued immediately. The news swept abroad over the whole island that the palladium of the public liberties was lost, maybe treasonably destroyed. Within 30 minutes almost the entire nation were in the courtroom, that is to say, the church. The impeachment of the chief magistrate followed, upon Stavely's motion. The accused met his misfortune with the dignity which became his great office. He did not plead, or even argue. He offered the simple defense that he had not meddled with the missing law, that he had kept the state archives in the same candle box that had been used as their depository from the beginning, and that he was innocent of the removal or destruction of the lost document. But nothing could save him. He was found guilty of misprision of treason, and degraded from his office, and all his property was confiscated. The lamest part of the whole shameful matter was the reason suggested by his enemies for his destruction of the law, to wit, that he did it to favor Christian, because Christian was his cousin, whereas Stavely was the only individual in the entire nation who was not his cousin. The reader must remember that all these people are the descendants of half a dozen men, that the first children intermarried together and bore grandchildren to the mutineers, that these grandchildren intermarried. After them, great and great-great-grandchildren intermarried. So that today everybody is blood kin to everybody. Moreover, the relationships are wonderfully, even astoundingly, mixed up and complicated. A stranger, for instance, says to an islander, "You speak of that young woman as your cousin. A while ago you called her your aunt. Well, she is my aunt, and my cousin too. And also my stepsister, my niece, my fourth cousin, my 33rd cousin, my 42nd cousin, my great aunt, my grandmother, my widowed sister-in-law, and next week she will be my wife." So the charge of nepotism against the chief magistrate was weak. But no matter, weak or strong, it suited Stavely. Stavely was immediately elected to the vacant magistracy, and, oozing reform from every pore, he went vigorously to work. In no long time religious services raged everywhere and unceasingly. By command, the second prayer of the Sunday morning service, which had customarily endured some 35 or 40 minutes, and had pleaded for the world, first by continent, and then by national and tribal detail, was extended to an hour and a half, and made to include supplications in behalf of the possible peoples in the several planets. Everybody was pleased with this. Everybody said, "Now this is something like." By command, the usual 3-hour sermons were doubled. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.